Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell me my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made you a judge or arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, the night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be?' So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God."
Carl McCunn was born to an army family. They were living in West Germany at the time. When he finished high school, he tried a semester of college before opting for a four-year stint in the Navy. When his military service was completed, he bounced around on the West Coast for a while, working odd jobs, gradually migrating north. Ultimately, he landed in Alaska. And for Carl, Alaska was a perfect fit. His passion was wildlife photography. So, what better spot could you live in the world than Alaska? He loved it there. In fact, in 1976, during the summertime, he wandered off in the wilderness all by himself and spent 5 months alone taking pictures. And so it didn't surprise his friend 5 years later in 1981 when he decided to do a return trip, this time 225 miles northeast of Fairbanks, back into the wilderness where he planned to spend the summer taking pictures. He assembled everything he would need. 1,400 pounds of supplies, camping gear, 500 rolls of film, all kinds of photographic equipment. He hired a bush pilot to fly him up in March and to drop him off. And everything went according to the plan. He spent the summer taking his pictures. And when you're doing something you love, time goes by quickly, doesn't it? And so before Carl knew it, March had faded into August. 5 months were about done. Supplies were beginning to run low. And in August, it was time for him to make his exit. Time to go back to civilization. And it was at that moment, in August, summer is ending. This isn't Texas, folks. It's Alaska. Summer's over in August. And as supplies dwindling, It was at that moment that for the very first time it dawned on Carl that he could not remember if he had made arrangements with that bush pilot to come back and pick him up. He wrote in his journal, "I think I should have used more foresight in arranging for my departure." Yeah. You think? As August wore on, Carl became more anxious with every day that passed. This wasn't a weekend at the state parks, folks. This was Alaska in the wilderness. This was a serious error. But not all hope was lost. Carl had friends who knew his schedule. And when he didn't come back, they got concerned. And so they went to the authorities, and the authorities talked to the bush pilot, and they were persuaded to send up a plane looking for him. And they found him. The pilot literally flew right over his campsite, and Carl heard the plane came out of his tent. He was thrilled. And as the plane banked for another pass and flew over, he raised his hand up, and he celebrated. Yes, I've been found. I'm going to be rescued. And it was only as the plane disappeared over the horizon that he remembered. This is the signal for a man on the ground to tell a pilot in the air, I am okay and I don't need any help. You think I'm making it up. I think it's a dumb signal too, but that is the signal. The pilot went back and told his friends, we found him. And he's fine. By October, he was struggling to find food. He wrote in his journal, it's been a terrible day, I won't get into it. Hand getting more frostbitten every day. Have only one meal of beans left. Honestly, I'm scared for my life. By November, the food was gone. And he was desperate. And he thought, maybe I could walk to Fort Yukon, closest civilization, 75 miles. But it's November, and it's Alaska, and conditions are terrible. And he, by now, is suffering from the effects of malnutrition physically. He was in no condition to make the journey under those conditions. That door had closed long before. Around Thanksgiving, he wrote in his journal, I feel miserable, have had the chills upon awakening for the past 3 days. I can't take much more of this. Among his final journal entries was this note, Dear God in heaven, please forgive me my weaknesses and sins. Please look over my family. And then he used his last bit of fuel for one more fire. And then one of the weapons he had brought with him to take his life. Authorities found his body in February. That's a terrible story, isn't it? But I must confess that the first time I heard it, I found it to be a terribly frustrating story. I mean, come on! If the guy had just done some kind of basic, obvious sort of things, he'd still be alive to tell about his misadventures, wouldn't he? And so I think it'd be very easy for you and I sitting in Kansas City, Missouri in March to look back on Carl and think, boy, that guy was a fool. Well, let's not be too quick. Because I have to tell you that the first time I heard his story, one of the very first thoughts that began to come to my mind was how similar his little adventure through the Alaskan wilderness, how similar his journey looks to the way a lot of people are making their journey through this life. Have you thought about that? Lots and lots of people are spending their time and their energy taking care of all the little details that pertain to getting through the day-to-day business of life. And they do that day after day and year after year. And what they never stop to contemplate is their exit. Do you realize that there are a lot of people living life with no strategy for getting out of here? And I just wonder, if we would judge Carl to be a fool because he went into the Alaska wilderness without an exit strategy, how much more foolish to make our way through this life and head toward our inevitable end with no plan for getting out of here. I want to talk to you about that for a little while tonight. Carl's story prods me to think about some things that I think the gospel says to us about our exit from this life. And so I want you to think with me for a little while this evening about our exit strategy, whether or not we have one. Before I get into that, I do want to tell you what a blessing it has to be with you again for the last few days. I looked it up today, Junior, while I was sitting at the table, and it was in the spring of 2006 that I was with this congregation for the very first time. So our relationship goes back 12 years over four different meetings, and I just think you guys are gluttons for punishment. Thank you for putting up with me that much. But I will tell you what it means is that of all the places that I go and do things like this, I think I know you folks as well as I know anybody. And that has been a great blessing to me. Thank you. I appreciate your shepherd so much. Glad that you've joined them recently, Phil. You are led by good men, and I count them as my friends. And we interact even when we're not doing something like this, and they bless my life, and I'm grateful for that. By the way, I talked to the old Mark today. Is that what y'all call him now? I talked to the old Mark today, and he said to tell all of you guys hello. I told him how much I was enjoying being back up here with you. And I will tell you, I'm thrilled about the new Mark who's come to be with you. I've known Mark since before Rachel. That's how far back we go, when he was just a young college student doing some internships in Joliet, Illinois. And we are awfully good friends. In fact, I shared with some folks this week, I don't think a week goes by that Mark and I don't talk. So it's been wonderful to be with them. And I'll tell you, folks, I'm glad that he and Rachel are here with you. You notice I didn't mention her. Rachel makes me feel bad because she was like in junior high school when I moved to Joliet to preach. She was one of my kids in Bible class. So those two have been very special to me, and I'm glad they're here because they're going to be very special to you as all of you guys work together in the years to come. I'm really happy about that relationship. And I'm grateful to all of you. So many of you have been here every single service, and you've come and you've attended carefully to the lessons, and you've had thoughtful feedback, and more than anything, that matters so much to me. We said on Sunday, if maybe along the way we could add a little something that will help you serve Jesus, we will have been successful. And I hope that we have done that. You're in our prayers that this work will grow and thrive and spread the gospel of Jesus in this community. But we're really grateful to get to spend this little bit of time with you, and we hope it's been of some value to you. Well, I need to preach, so I want to talk to you about your exit strategy. I want to mention three things about the end that I think the Gospels make us think about. Things I see and I'm pondered to or pushed to think about because of Carl's story. The first thing I want to mention is this. When I read Carl's story, I'm reminded that the end is coming. I think about that because he knew that, didn't he? As he headed off into the Alaskan wilderness, he wasn't putting down roots, folks. He wasn't going there to stay. He wasn't building a cabin that he planned to live in indefinitely. He was only going for the summer, right? It was planned all along that the time would come, and not too far into the future, when he would make his exit. So it just begs the question then, if the guy went in knowing he was going to have to leave, how could it ever be that he wouldn't make plans for that, that he wouldn't have a strategy for getting out? Do you already know the answer to that? I don't think it's very hard to figure out. I think this guy loved taking pictures. And I think when he got off there to planning the trip and then off into the wilderness, that's all he thought about. Was indulging his passion. He was consumed with that, and his mind just didn't go there. Will you let Carl's predicament simmer for a minute? And then appreciate the fact that all of us know that our journey is coming to an end as well. We know that, right? You can't be a Bible student read the Bible at any depth at all without being confronted regularly with those powerful biblical reminders about the end that is coming. I want you to see that with me. I'm headed over to the book of Hebrews. Will you go there in your Bible? I want to look at Hebrews 9 for a minute. I want to start there. Because I think here in Hebrews 9, the Holy Spirit will lay down for us three foundation stones in what will be the biblical message about the end that is coming. And so I'm in Hebrews 9 and I'm going to verse 27. Are you there? Hebrews 9, verse 27, Hebrews writer says, "And inasmuch as it is appointed for men to die once, and after this comes judgment, so Christ also, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time for salvation without reference to sin to those who eagerly await him." And so let's work through this text for a minute. First of all, in verse 27, you'll notice he says that it is appointed for men to die once. There's the first stone in the foundation of Bible teaching: death. We are going to die, right? It is hard to escape that reality. And it isn't just because it's in the Bible. It's because it's happening all the time, everywhere, all around us. And sometimes it hits really close to home. And it's people that we know and people that we love. And we're reminded, death is reality for every man. But that's not where the end of Bible teaching, or that's not where Bible teaching ends. And so in verse 28, you notice he talks about Christ appearing a second time. So death is coming. And then the second stone in this foundation of Bible teaching is the second coming of Jesus Christ. We've already known he's come once to rescue man from sin, to be that sacrifice for us. The Bible promises, in fact, the Bible promises when he left us, that he would come again. And so people who believe the Bible know that there's a day coming when the trumpet is going to sound and Jesus Christ is going to come back. So death is a reality, right? And then there's the return of Christ. And then go back up to verse 27 because there's something else mentioned there. Do you see it? It is appointed for men to die once, and after this comes judgment. When Christ returns, men will be judged. They will give an account for their lives. So as we make our way through the New Testament, those three ideas keep popping up again and again and again. Death, return, judgment. And so I'm headed back to the Gospel of Matthew because Jesus talked about that at some length in Matthew chapter 25. In Matthew 25, down in verse 31, he would say, "But when the Son of Man comes in his glory with all his angels with him," there's the return, there's that piece of the message, "then he will sit on his glorious throne, and all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them from one another as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats." And from there, Jesus expounds on this idea of judgment, of men giving an account for the lives that they have lived. How many New Testament passages talk about that? In fact, if you'll jump ahead to the book of 2 Peter, what Peter will contend is that these realities, these fundamental Bible truths about the end, death is coming, the Lord is going to return, we're going to be judged, they ought to impact how disciples lived every day. So I'm in 2 Peter 3, look down at verse number 10, 2 Peter 3, 10. "But the day of the Lord will come like a thief," there's the return, "in which the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the elements will be destroyed with intense heat, and the earth and its works will be burned up." Now listen to verse 11. "Since all these things are to be destroyed in this way, what sort of people ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be destroyed by burning and the elements will melt with intense heat? But according to his promise, we are looking for a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells." Now listen to 14. "Therefore, beloved, since you look for these things," do you see it? Since you know the end is coming, "be diligent to be found by him in peace, spotless and blameless." Twice in this little section, I think Peter fundamentally says the same thing. Because these are the things that you believe, the death is coming, and Christ will return, and men will be judged, you ought to behave yourself in a certain way. You ought to be holy and godly and spotless and blameless. These realities should impact life every single day. Disciples live with an eye to the skies. We are anticipating. What is his language there? Did you see it in verse 12? Looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God. We know the end is coming. In fact, it is a powerful reality. It changes how I choose to behave every single day, right? Well, that's the theory. Maybe not so much in reality. You know that I've not begun to exhaust the references, right? In fact, the truth is, what I've done with this sermon is I've gone out and back and I've kind of marked through a few passages. I've got more here I could mention. I mentioned some of them last night, like 2 Thessalonians 1. How long y'all want to stay? We go on for a while. And what I've done with the verses I've cited is I've skimmed right across the surface. We could pause and dig down. We could do a sermon tonight on Matthew 25. Again, how long you want to stay? There's a lot to be talked about. I'm only mentioning the passages for this reason. You can't be a Bible student and not know that there is an end coming. Which raises the same question we were asking about Carl. If we know that, how could it ever be that anybody would live day by day with no exit strategy, no plan for getting out? And I think probably for the same reason Carl forgot to talk to that bush pilot about coming back. We get caught up in the excitement of the journey. And frankly, with Disney World and iPhones and college basketball, there's a lot to engage us, isn't there? And to keep us distracted. Our minds get so occupied with this world and its stuff that we rarely let them drift to thoughts about the end. I think that's about right. If that's where we're at, then let me add this second admonition. And I pull this from Carl's story too. Carl's story makes me think about the fact that it's really important to know what matters. We need to know what matters. You know, when I think about Carl, I imagine that from the front end of his story, from Spring's perspective, he must have looked like a pretty smart guy. And I tell you what I mean when I say that. I've imagined what his living room must have looked like in March, a week or so before he took off on this trip. I don't get the impression that he was a very neat and tidy guy. I don't mean to judge, but I know how the story came out, okay? But I can kind of look around his living room and see the boxes filled with all those supplies and the cases with the photographic equipment. I bet he took really good care of that stuff. It was special to him. And all the boxes with the film and then tents and sleeping bags. And he took 3 rifles with him. I can kind of see those propped up over in the corner. I would have taken more than 3 if I was going into the Alaskan wilderness. And I guess if we'd been looking around his living room at all that stuff, our thought would have been, boy, this guy's got his act together. He has everything that he needs for a most excellent journey. That's how it looked on the front end, right? But from the back end of his journey, from fall's perspective, when you get to August and September, suddenly he doesn't look like such a smart guy, doesn't he? He looks like a fool. Suddenly the one oversight, the one omission is so glaring that it makes all of those other preparations look pointless. What good does it do to use up 500 rolls of film with no plan for getting the stuff out, right? He did come to figure out how important it was to have an exit strategy. He just got all that squared away too late. And so when I think about that part of the story, it occurs to me how similar that is to the way people live their lives, isn't it? We get all wrapped up and consumed with all the stuff that pertains to this life, doing all the things that we believe are important for this journey. And so from the times our kids are little bitty, we're talking to them about the importance of going to school and making good grades, right? Embarrassed to admit, I checked report cards in kindergarten, okay? I don't even think those count, but I was looking at it. And we were talking about how important it was to get good grades. Why are we so hung up about that? Well, they need to get good grades so they can get into a good school, right? Maybe get a scholarship and ease some of that financial burden on mom and dad, right? But to what end? Someone says, well, duh, come on, David, so you can get a great education. Yes. For what purpose? Unless they get a job. Yes, we all want our children to get jobs. That is a great development in the life of parenting, I will tell you. But not just any job, a great job where they can excel and do well and prosper. And be able to live the American dream. Nice house. Nice cars. Great vacations. All the latest and coolest gadgets. And you know, if you can do that, if you can go to school and make good grades and get a great education and go out and find a great job and prosper in that job and get all the financial benefits that come with that and buy a nice big house out in the country and drive nice cars and have all the latest, coolest gadgets, all your friends will look at you and they will put their stamp of approval on that and say, you have made it. We say in America, you're living the American dream, and your company will give you plaques to put on your wall acknowledging your great success, and maybe they'll have a banquet for you and all of that. Culture will say, you've made it, you've done it, you've accomplished what really matters. I'm not sure that's always God's assessment. Because I think about the story that was read for us in Luke 12. Do you remember that? We started there. And it occurs to me that that was a man living the American dream. He'd started a business. And it was a successful business. It was so successful that he was beginning to expand and need bigger facilities. In fact, this guy had done so well that he got to retire early. He didn't need to worry about working anymore. He just gets to go sit on a beach chair somewhere and watch the sunsets. And we would look at a man like that in America, and we would say, he made it. He was successful. He had done what is really important in life. Question, was that God's assessment of it? God said in verse 20, you're a fool. Why? Can I be clear about something? Because I always get in trouble for this. People come away and think that I'm saying it's bad to have stuff. Do you know that's not why the man in Luke 12 was in trouble? God is not critical of the fact that he had built a successful business, nor that he had accumulated wealth. Folks, wealth is not a sin in the Bible, okay? The problem was not with what he had. The problem was with what he did not have. Verse 21 says that he was not rich toward God. He had a lot of stuff, just none of the stuff that mattered. Do you see that? And what Luke 12 is trying to say to us is that it is absurd to spend our lives collecting a bunch of stuff that in the grand scheme is valueless while never collecting the stuff that does. And just like in Carl's story, from the back end of the story, that's going to make sense to everybody. Nobody's going to get to God on Judgment Day and say, let me talk to you about where I went to college. By the way, have you checked my file and seen the grades that I made? Have you noticed the profits in my division for the last quarter? We led the company. And oh God, you need to check out my new car. It talks to me. Nobody's going to say that on Judgment Day. We need to be very careful that we don't make the mistake that Carl made, and that is failing to recognize what really matters until it's too late to do anything about it. And so that brings me to the final admonition that I take away from his story, and that is this. We do get cues periodically about what really matters, and we need to make sure we don't miss them. I mention that because for me, that is the most frustrating part of Carl's story. Even after blowing it and forgetting to make arrangements for someone to pick him up, even after blowing it and missignaling the rescue pilot, he still had an option. He could have done something about his predicament. In August, maybe even September, the weather was still reasonably good, not for me, but for him. He still had some provisions. He was still physically strong. Do you see where this is going? In September, he could have packed up, taken one of those weapons, taken some supplies, and he could have started walking. 75 miles to Fort Yukon. Those who know Carl's story have wondered why he didn't do that. Why did he wait till November to think about that? We can only speculate. I wonder if he looked at those 500 rolls of film and reconsidered. I guarantee you, folks, if you're walking 75 miles through the Alaskan wilderness with bears, you're carrying supplies and guns, not undeveloped film. To make that choice would have involved sacrifices, even danger. But the frustrating thing about his story is that there was a moment where it was all in his hands and he could have done something. He could have saved himself. I think we get cues too. I think there are moments in life when every one of us are reminded where this journey is headed that we're on. And that we're going to reach the end, and more than anything else, we need a plan for getting out. If at no other time, how about at funerals? Would you head over to Ecclesiastes chapter 7? In Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 2, Solomon says this really weird thing. Ecclesiastes 7:2, he says, it is better to go to a house of mourning than to a house of feasting. If we could modernize that a little bit, he's saying, it is better for you to go to a funeral than to a party. And I got to tell you, folks, in 2018, that is lost on American culture. My job requires me to be at lots of funerals. I've been doing that for 30 years. And what I have noticed is that the crowds at funerals, they're changing. The crowds are getting older and more gray. Young people don't go to funerals. Have you noticed that? Now have a party, a Super Bowl party, serve barbecue, and you get a crowd of young people at that. Have somebody die, even in the church family, and who comes? Why is that? Why don't we like going to funerals? Well, back in Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 2, it is better to go to a house of mourning than to a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man. There's your problem. That's why we don't like to go. Because when we go to a funeral, we sit there in the crowd and we look at that box and we are forced to acknowledge that this is not some special tragedy that befell this person, but that in reality, this is how the journey ends for everyone. It makes me acknowledge that one day it will be my friends who come together. And someone will rise and they will talk about my life. And it will be my empty shell lying in my box. Yeah, there's one for me too. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. You got to go sit at a funeral and think about that. And so I think most people just quit going. But you can't dodge funerals forever, right? Because sometime it's going to be someone important. When mama dies, you better show up or the family's coming looking for you, and it isn't going to be pretty, right? So no matter how well we may efficiently stay busy at other times, when mom and dad die, we've got to show up and we've got to look and we've got to think. So if everyone ultimately has to confront that reality, why is it then that some people still don't have an exit strategy? Maybe for the same reason Carl never started walking. It is hard to change. When I have wandered away from Jesus and I've gotten down the path of sin, I will tell you folks, the further you get down the path, it gets harder and harder to come back. And when you get hooked up in enslaving sins, letting go of that, turning around, coming back, admitting that your parents were right, God forbid, it's hard. And so people go to funerals, and it tweaks them. I got to tell you, man, as a preacher, I see the suffering people just trying to get through this awful reminder. And it bugs them. It bugs them that day. And my guess, it bugs them into the next week, maybe the next month. But you know what happens eventually? You get over it. And it doesn't bug you anymore. And you miss your cues. And sadly, people keep missing their cues and keep missing their cues until they end up like Carl. Too late to do anything about it. Several years ago, the church that I was working with decided that we wanted to do a better job of reaching out to some of our fellow disciples that we had lost along the way. Over several years, we'd had some people who were making the journey with us, and for a variety of reasons had turned back. And you know, the Bible says, do not regard those people as enemies, but admonish them as brothers, right? We wanted to be true to that responsibility. And so, toward the end of 1 year, in the late fall, we constructed this list of about 50 of our spiritual loved ones that we had lost along the way. And we decided that during the latter part of that year, we were going to reach out to those people. We had a team that we put together, and that team began to write notes, send cards, write letters. In some cases, they made some phone calls and actually went out and visited with some of our wayward folks. And then in January, we planned a series of lessons with those people in mind. We published the titles and sent them to those people and told them, we want you to come in January. You know how that is. People are taking inventory at the end of the year, making resolutions. We were hoping for some of the people, maybe that might be the resolution to come back to the Lord. And so we reached out and we planned the series. And January came, we preached through all the lessons, and some of them showed up. But we went all the way through the month, and nobody had turned back. Nobody was restored. And we were kind of depressed about that. It felt like we'd made all that effort and had no fruit to show. The truth was, we weren't patient enough. Because as we got into February, there were a couple of responses, and then into March and a couple of more. By the time we got 3 months into that, at the end of April, there had been 7 people that were restored. One of our guys had lost all 3 of his daughters, and in that time period, all 3 came back. And boy, we were celebrating that. Out of the 50 we reached out to, 7 had been restored. I'm sad to tell you that Howard Green wasn't among the seven. He was on the list of 50. I remember the day he was born again. I was there. It was a Thursday. I got a knock on my office door in the middle of the afternoon. One of our elders poked his head in the door and said, "We're getting ready to have a new birth. You'll want to see this." And I did. And I came into our mostly empty auditorium, and the curtains had been opened up, and there was this elder in the baptistry with Howard Green. And I watched his new birth, and I hugged his neck, and I welcomed him into the family. There were about 30 people like Howard that year. So I have to be honest with you and say that I knew Howard, and I always greeted him when we passed each other at services. I can't say we had become really good friends. He was one of 30 new Christians that year. But we interacted a little bit. And he was with us about a year, maybe a year and a half. And then, as sometimes happened, it happened with Simon the Sorcerer, the old weeds began to grow up in his life, and there began to be some evil influences that worked on him and started tugging at him. And he kind of gave into some of those influences, and he started back in some old patterns of life that drug him into sin. And when we realized that was happening, we tried to come to his rescue, and we appealed and tried to study and persuade and bring him back, but he just went deeper and deeper off onto that wrong path, and ultimately we had to withdraw fellowship from him. So he was on our list. He was one of the 50. Some of the people that knew him wrote him cards, sent him letters. I think some people called. And I remember the Sunday night, I remember the room we were in when the team came together, and one of our team members spoke up and said, "I heard from Howard this week. I need to tell y'all something." He said, "Howard called me, and he said, I want you to tell the people at that church to leave me alone. I've been getting these cards in the mail, and you called me, and look, I'm not coming back. And you're not going to change my mind. So no more calls and no more cards." What do you do with that? Well, we felt like we had to honor his request. He closed the door. And so our team agreed that night to take Carl or Howard off the list. We weren't going to make any more calls. That was Sunday night. On Thursday, he went in for a minor medical procedure. Routine stuff. While they had him on the table, there were some unexpected complications. And 4 days later, Howard died. And as I look back, I can't help but wonder if it wasn't the providential work of God in those months leading up to that moment when God was trying to say, "Howard, the end is coming. You need to realize what matters and take this cue. And get your life straightened out." He didn't do it. Just like Carl. So here's what I'm going to say to you tonight. I don't know what this sermon is doing to you. Maybe it's really bugging you, because you know you don't have a plan for getting out of here. You need to do something about that. And you need to do it right now. You make your way to the front while we stand, while we sing.